Gospel of John is different in all kinds of ways, but one of them is that it doesn't have the kind of what we call the institution of the Eucharist in the Last Supper. The Last Supper discourse goes on for pages and pages, but he doesn't have, or she doesn't have that. Rather, he has this little speech that was created after the multiplication of the loaves and fish, where Jesus describes himself as the living bread. But we know that the celebration of this memorial of the Lord's Last Supper goes back to the very earliest days. We have it in Paul, this passage from 1 Corinthians, is the, one of the earliest writings in the New Testament, and Paul just takes it for granted that people knew that they would get together and celebrate the Lord's Supper. And so what I want to do is try to get to this business of Jesus as the living bread and Paul's understanding of the Last Supper as life-giving or as a sign of life. Apparently, the early Jesus followers met in people's houses. Obviously, they didn't have churches. And so they would be groups of maybe 20 to 40 people at the outside. And before they celebrated this memorial of the Last Supper, they would have a common meal, just a regular meal. And Corinth, which is a fairly sophisticated town, had, just like most of the Greco-Roman world, vast differences between the wealthy and the poor. And apparently there was a mixture of people in this particular congregation that Paul addressed. And there was a problem because the wealthy people would bring their food, you know, pate, quail, and nice Portuguese rolls, and sit in the corner while the poor people didn't, either didn't have anything or ate stuff that was not very good. And then they would have the Lord's Supper. Paul was outraged. And he puts it just as starkly as we find it any place in the New Testament. You people don't even recognize this memorial of the Lord because you eat as with no consciousness of each other at all. You do not recognize the body of the Lord. And he was talking about the community. You are not aware of each other in any kind of inclusive way. So how in God's name can you say you're celebrating the Lord's Supper? If Jesus is to give life, what does it mean, therefore, to be alive? It means precisely to walk around as part of the transformation of one's consciousness so that the other exists as part of my very own self-definition. I cannot think of myself without thinking inclusively of the other, especially the other in need. It's enormously important because we all walk around thinking about the others. We have ample evidence today. I picked up three over the week. Enron, Merrill Lynch, George Bush, the Roman Church. There's something constant in those four instances where all of those institutions think about the other officially at their highest echelon. The other was somebody to either be taken advantage of, to be used, or more typically, as in the case of the Roman Church, to be seen as the villainous other who is assaultive on me, which is, I think, my normal way of looking at other people. They're all potential enemies. I do think about the others. They're all potential enemies. What is that one going to do to me? The secular press, the pansexualized society, homosexuals, the enemies of the church. If you look at everything that has come out in regard to the pedophilia scandal, there's not been a single word except for Rembert Wheatland's apology in the cathedral in Milwaukee that is not accusatory. fault. It's their fault that we have this problem. It's not our fault. You'll notice there's a very clear sense of who one is, but the sense of the other as not only alien, but as antagonist. George Bush will talk about saving civilization. He will talk about the axis of evil. And what does he say? Nothing more than the same. This man who's filled his administration with Enron executives, who's done so much to damage the environment, stands outside the world and everybody else's judgment about how the world ought to go in regard to pollution, for example, and stands self-righteously seeing everybody else as real or the axis of evil, the axis of evil. Note the language. Is he thinking about all those other people? Certainly he is, but how is he thinking about those other people? People at Merrill Lynch who've lied to their own clients. Oh, buy this stock. This is great. Why, all interior memos say this is a piece of rubbish. So they're fined $100 million, which probably doesn't mean a whole lot. Enron, everybody's aware of how many thousands of people were cheated, lost their entire savings. By literally the head people made out like bandits. That's a way of thinking about the other. And I confess, it's my way of thinking about the other too, normally. But that's not what Paul says about thinking about the other. He will make extraordinary and outrageous sounding claims. We are members of each other. We are members of each other. So if I cannot think about my own integrity, my own well-being, my own growth, my own sense of being alive, without including those others, not as enemies, but as co-human beings. So that I am to look at them, and they are to look at me as enabling each other to grow, to become alive. Extraordinarily difficult thing. But let me just take one strategy. Because I said that what the official church is doing is reprehensible. What Merrill Lynch is doing is reprehensible. What George Bush is doing is reprehensible. What the Enron people have done is certainly reprehensible. I have made judgments. And this is really an important thing. Because we're told not to judge, are we not? Don't judge. And of course, a kind of simplistic reading of that text has given rise to a kind of sanctification of Pollyannaism. I'm all right. No problem. Everything is beautiful in its own way. No, everything is not beautiful. And I should be able to say what is ugly. The simulation, the outright lies, the treatment of the other as enemy, whereby that's the way I define myself within this kind of fortress mentality, as you see over and over from the Vatican, from the White House, maybe from every center of power. I suspect so. Even at King's College, I understand there are instances of this heaven forfend. So what does it mean not to judge? is really not so difficult, I don't think. How many of us, if we're true and honest with ourselves, can even assess our own motivation for doing what we do? And I think that's where the issue of judgment lies. I cannot condemn somebody else's heart because I don't know what's in that heart, just as I don't know what's in my heart. But that doesn't mean I end up with this mindless kind of so-called Christianity, which looks at the world in this bland, nondescript fashion. But rather, a distinction is made between what people do and the impact it has on other human beings and why they do. It seems to me that's where the issue of judgment lies. Can I judge what people do and its consequences for other human beings? Yeah. Bishops in Dallas next week may actually listen to some victims of abuse for a change. They may listen to some layboys. I'm not so sure George Bush is capable of listening to anybody else, frankly. There will be a distinction made, I think, what has happened and why it has happened. And so I cannot judge, I cannot ascribe motives to people, which I do all the time, of course. I was struck a couple weeks ago, twice in a week, I was really taken aback by people making seemingly offhand comments to me. The implication of where they really knew what was in my heart and what was going on in me. It's something I do all the time, but I had to hear it from outside directed to me to become sensitive to that. And yet the Eucharist, precisely to make us alive, is to enable us to listen to the other, to that mysterious other, and to approach that mysterious other with the greatest possible reverence, greatest possible reluctance to ascribe motivation. And that, I think, is what being alive is. So we live in this, you know, we like to think we live in this nice, brightly lit room. We don't live in this nice, brightly lit room. The world is not a nice, brightly lit room. The world has much more darkness than light. And of course, we're all scared of the dark. To be called into that darkness, to say, that's where the real and the true and the honest and the truly vital and alive process of existence goes on. I think that's what the Eucharist is about. So we're all going to come up here in a few minutes to take Sumerino's bread that we believe has been turned somehow into the presence of Jesus. We must know that when we do that, what we're trying to do is break open the kind of encapsulation that is our normal form of consciousness, at least it is for me, to allow the other space, even if I don't know how precisely they feel that. But only that, you see, being alive. The Vatican is not alive to the extent that it excludes everybody else and accuses everybody else. Nor is Merrill Lynch alive as a human institution to the extent that it simply rips everybody else off in the name of greater profits or Enron. George Bush is not alive to the extent that everybody else is demonized. They're not alive. some kind of dwarfish, mouth-shaped, and dangerous presence in the world. Not a lie. I am the living bread. I am the living bread. And that's what the cost of to project our life and hope of becoming part of that living bread, that live flow. So we really are members of it.